Hi, this is Perry Cullen with the next episode of Conversations with Perry and Friends on our podcast. And this episode is really going to be an interesting one because we're going to talk about the changing role of the hospital in healthcare. We've talked about physicians, we've talked about other aspects of healthcare, but now we're going to get inside the hospital, which is under a lot of pressure these days. And so I took a friend of mine out of the pressure cooker, Rita Shane, and said, Rita, let's go talk about the world of hospitals. So Rita is the Vice President and Chief Pharmacy Officer at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California. I've known her for a few decades. But Rita, to kick it off, can you share a bit about your background and the work that you do?
Certainly. So as you indicated, based on my title, I am a pharmacist by training, and I've had progressively advanced roles in the organization over the decades that I've been here. I chose to stay here because it's such a rich environment for collaboration. Working with the medical staff, which has really been the majority of the focus of my work, has been incredibly enriching. And the opportunity to advance not only the role of the pharmacist, but patient safety has been a critical part of what I do. At the same time, The financial headwinds, which is becoming a trite word, have been there for many, many years. And my goodness, my practice in pharmacy began right before the advent of DRGs. So this notion of balancing the clinical financial interface has always been of interest to me. And being involved in interdisciplinary collaborations with teams across the organization and with leadership, and now with executive leadership, has stimulated me, and frankly, why I'm still working.
Well, that's amazing. You still show up to work and carry that patient safety thing. My hat goes off to you. So tell me, what has inspired you at Cedars-Sinai all these years, kept you motivated?
Well, Cedars-Sinai has always thrived on excellence. In fact, it's not been In Search of Excellence, which was a book many, many decades ago. It's kind of been almost frenzied because we have really advanced to becoming an academic medical center, even though we are a community organization. I mean, that's how we began. That's our roots. But over the course of years, as we've identified the needs of the patients that we serve, we have recruited some amazing clinicians to work here, you know, first in class. Obviously, we've also benefited from being acknowledged in various reports, U.S. News and World Report and others. So being with the best has kept me here, because why would I go anywhere else? Especially since, as I've said, I've had remarkable relationships with not only medical staff, but with our leaders.
Okay. And L.A. is such a great place to hang out, right?
Well, it is.
It has its moments, right? So here's the big question. How has the role of the hospital changed in healthcare since you began your career through today?
So, you know, I look at healthcare. We, in hospitals, we essentially react to something that went wrong. So I've always said that unless someone's having a baby, coming to the hospital means something went wrong. And it became evident even in the 90s that we needed to go beyond that. I think that was, in my mind, the advent of managed care. I think you probably could tell me the exact year in the 90s. But certainly in the 90s, we really thought we would be managing from cradle to grave. We were looking at pop health, you know, or integrated healthcare delivery systems were going to be the way that we were all structured. And yet that didn't really take off. It did in pockets around the country. We're well aware of group health was one of the ones on the West Coast, remember?
Right.
That being said, I think more and more as we look at the aging population, baby boomers like ourselves, it's evident that we need to have a thoughtful approach to supporting that patient's well-being. So if they come into the hospital, of course, we've got to resolve the acute exacerbation that they're here for. But we have started over the course of the last probably decade plus really focusing on how we ensure a safe transition, which happens to be one of my areas of not only obsession, but an area I've really invested in professionally, research-wise, and even advocacy work, because we have to ensure that patient can safely go home, they and their family can care for them. And that's going to, I think, continue to be a focus for health systems.
Okay. Well, with these increasing financial pressures on hospitals that we see every day, especially rural hospitals, How have these pressures impacted patients?
Well, we certainly hear and read the stories. The access issue, the lack of being able to see a primary care physician because of the primary care physician shortage have had a huge impact on patients. So they show up in the emergency department, not only in rural hospitals, but pretty much everywhere. We hear about emergency departments and people staying in emergency departments for hours and days because of lack of beds, because of our aging population and how sick people are. So clearly the concerns we all have is how do we manage these patients so they don't end up in the ED? No patient that's sick wants to be there. How do we create incentives for primary care physicians? I'm married to an internist who actually worked way beyond retirement, but it was exhausting observing how busy he was with his panel of patients and his inbox that was always overflowing. It's very, very challenging from a physician side. But for our patients, this access issue, not just to care, but to these high cost therapies that are, we'll talk about, I'm sure, because it's one of my top five priorities because of concerns about how do we treat patients with devastating diseases.
All right. So I hear the hospital's perspective, how it impacts patients. But for our audience, what are strategies that hospitals are using to reduce total cost of care? And I don't mean the cost of care of the inpatient stay. I'm talking about the whole healthcare dollar.
So we have seen a lot of work in trying to reduce readmissions. I mean, that has been a huge theme. Part of it motivated by penalties from CMS for 30-day readmissions. Our organization actually embarked on the bundled payment care initiative to really focus on the Medicare population to reduce readmissions, being accountable for 90 days on the 90-day episode, the anchor episode being the hospitalization and beyond. A lot of focus on supporting that patient, as I've mentioned, not just managing the acute care episode, but looking at how they can have what I call a safe landing. Because it's like taking a car that's been totaled and you bring the car in and you take them to the body shop. That's what I sometimes call the hospital, the body shop. And if we don't really work towards preparing that patient, as I've mentioned, to go home or to wherever their post-acute facility care is going to be rendered, if we don't get that right, you might as well take this beautiful car and drive it off a cliff.
Okay. All right. That's an interesting perspective. So now I want to find out how your experience has shaped your thinking about the healthcare landscape. And I'll just throw out a couple of talking points. So diagnosing diseases, how's that changed over the decades?
Well, when we look at the advances in imaging and laboratory in terms of what we can actually evaluate and become more precise, look at the biomarkers that are now available, we now can more accurately identify whether or not a patient has Alzheimer's disease. So we are able to more precisely manage patients. I think there's also been some what I would call overuse that comes as a result of that. I mean, we hear of patients who go and have a total MRI every year to see if there's something cooking there. Now, sometimes there are things that are cooking there, but they don't necessarily need attention. So there's the other side of this problem. So clearly we've seen advances with our ability to diagnose diseases.
Okay. So let's talk about post-acute care. Changes that have happened with that.
Well, that's become more and more important. More in organizations like ours have worked with some of our post-acute partners. We have close collaborators, for example, that we work with to support the quality and safety across the continuum of care, whether it be ensuring that the patients that go to some of these post-acute facilities have appropriate infection control processes in place, providing even training. We do have clinicians going to support training in those organizations to reduce complications for the patient and also prevent them from being readmitted. I think as we look at the aging population in the U.S., post-acute care has to be a priority for every health system. And some health systems have them integrated within their own organization.
Right. So now let's talk about a little bit about technology's impact. Electronic health records. How's that happened?
Oh, goodness gracious. I grew up with the paper world and clearly there's a lot to be said for being able to access information about a patient anywhere. And obviously, to the extent that we can have interoperability and have the ability to view patients across different healthcare entities, that ensures that we're not continually asking the patient to provide us with a history that may or may not be inaccurate. That being said, electronic health records also create confirmation bias because of requirements for documentation that sometimes get cut and pasted even when they're not accurate. And we have what we call the note bloat. So try to find information in an electronic health record can be challenging at times because of the amount of documentation that occurs, whether it's a response to a regulatory requirement or to support billing.
Note bloat. I gotta make a note of that one. Now let's roll into telemedicine and, you know, the patient, physician, digitally.
Right. So COVID really brought telemedicine to light. And I think telemedicine has a role and can be extremely effective, especially when one needs to follow up with a patient to support post-discharge care, for example. It can also replace a visit for some diseases and conditions where that telehealth visit might rule out a need to come in and see a physician or a healthcare practitioner in person and facilitate timely management of a patient's condition. So it really does have a role. Unfortunately, there have been some changes in reimbursement that went into effect October 1st that are adversely affecting some of our Medicare population. But that being said, I do believe telemedicine has a significant role, not only in treatment, but in prevention as well.
Is there a fear of overutilization?
At this juncture, I don't think so. I actually think it fills a void, and especially for patients who otherwise would have trouble getting access because of shortage of primary care physicians or other physicians who are too busy.
Yeah. And for, you know, our audience, a lot of them would provide the insurance coverage for these activities. Let's just move back to post-acute care. Do you guys hit your head against the wall, the insurance companies, when you try to do post-acute care? They don't say it's covered, or they're not as well, progressive as you guys are?
There are issues, obviously, that case management has to navigate to support ensuring that the patient can go to a post-acute care provider. I mean, the ideal state would have been going, is it back to the future or back to the past? If we had actually achieved the vision of integrated healthcare delivery in the 90s, we would be in a better place 30 years ago. I mean, I can't believe I am saying the same things that I even wrote about in the 90s of the vision of what it would look like, you know, a true integrated healthcare system. And look, Geisinger I can't remember their new name, but Geisinger accomplished it. And as have others across the country. So,
yeah. Well, and plus living in California, you're in the shadow of Kaiser every day. So that's biasing our perspective. All right. Let's move back to technology a little bit. How will technology and AI transform healthcare for patients and physicians?
So for patients, I think the access to information, which we're already seeing patients, you know, have Googled things for years now, it is important. The concern I have is the accuracy of the information, because one can pull up almost anything. And frankly, personally, I use it all the time whenever I need anything repaired. I use the internet, and AI helps me figure out what I need to do. But that being said, for one cannot always assume that what one's reading is correct. So I think it will help patients be informed, but it may have the unintended consequence of being misinformed and believing what they're seeing, and self-treatment or use of products that may actually be deleterious to them.
Okay. And what are the risks with the above? What's the risk with this whole AI?
I think that depending on the source of the information, patients could stop taking medications. They would not access a physician when they needed to, because they would believe that the information that's being rendered is accurate. So for example, if someone has different conditions and they go in to say, what do I do about a condition? And AI responds, directs them that they need self-care, where in fact what they're experiencing, let's talk about a headache. You know, a headache. Yep. Well, what do I do for a headache? And it could be a stroke. And yet AI's, doesn't say, you know, ask a series of questions thoughtfully, and hopefully with as AI evolves, this won't happen. But if AI doesn't ask a series of questions, someone with a stroke in progress could not go to an emergency department where they need to be treated immediately.
All right. So can you give me an example today at Cedars-Sinai how you guys are using AI?
So we have AI. We have a virtual platform that's assisting nurses with documentation when they're talking to the patient. That's actually fabulous. As one example, we are looking similarly at AI to help educate patients by using different platforms. We are about to implement AI to help support prior authorization for prescription drugs. And
really?
Yeah, we are. So those are some applications we're really excited about. But each one of those has been thoughtfully evaluated with lots and lots of people, clinical people, as well as our IT experts to support effective, safe use. And we're looking at AI and research as well. So, I mean, with the right guardrails and the right stakeholders, AI is extremely powerful. And machine learning is extremely powerful. I think it actually will reduce a lot of work to enable, ideally, clinicians to have information to support effective decision making, as opposed to trying to mire through, right, as I mentioned, you know, a very, very bloated electronic health record. So to bring information to support decision making is really positive. The concern is always, are we going to lose the ability to critically think because we're just going to go with the AI? We're savants, and are people going to actually understand and learn how to treat diseases? I mean, it's kind of like ask someone to do math in their head these days.
Right.
You know, maybe you and I can do it, but I don't bust and ask the generations after us. I can still add in my head.
I heard that. So now let's move into value-based care. We hear that buzzword a lot. What is your organization doing to provide value-based care?
So we will assemble teams around specific diseases and conditions to identify key areas where we believe we can improve the care of the patient and potentially reduce the total cost of care. So I'll give you a pharmacy example. We know that cancer patients, depending on their treatments, are at risk for febrile neutropenia, which means that they could potentially be admitted because their white count plummets after getting certain chemotherapies. So we actually hardwired antimicrobial prescribing into our treatment plan so that a patient who's at risk of an admission because of an infection actually goes home with a prescription for antibiotics. This was done through a multidisciplinary team and also with our IT colleagues. And we actually saw a significant increase in the number of patients going home with antibiotics. Now we're measuring outcomes because we believe, based on what we see in admissions, and this is not just here, this is across the country, patients get admitted when their white count plummets and they get infected. So this is to prevent the infection. So that's like a value-based initiative, if you will. And we have other ones across the organization with different diseases and conditions where we look at how do we reduce the total cost of care and do the right thing for the patient that will actually improve their care once they leave. You know, this notion of patients leaving safely is very, very important.
So is this all germinated inside Cedars, or is a payer working with you or directing you or collaborating with you?
These have been within Cedars. I could get into what I believe would be the ideal state with payers if you want to go there. Because I do think there are opportunities to really support not only payers, but employers in reducing overall healthcare costs, because there are a lot of misaligned, models of how payment is rendered in this country.
All right. Well, this is a nice segue to our final question. Okay. Now you get to look at your crystal ball and you say, what do you see as the top five priorities for health systems going forward? What are our top five priorities?
So I would say it's really going to what I'm going to call a hybrid approach to the patient's admission. It's somewhat, I'm repeating somewhat of what I said before. I think the priority is to determine what the patient needs when they go home. So one of the terms I use when I'm teaching is, why is the patient here and what do they need? And the answer isn't just to replace their hip, you know, make sure that they survive their acute myocardial infarction or fill in the blank. We need to look at what are the other factors around the patients. We have the highest percentage of patients over 80 years old at Cedars-Sinai. I don't know if it's in the country, but it's certainly within the state. And those patients and their family members need support. And it may be psychosocial support. It may not even be
medical, right?
Medical support. And so I do think that absolutely has to be a priority. How do we huddle around that patient and in an intelligent way, figure out what they need to send them home? And I think that's where AI and technology can help us, because that information that's being fed through the medical record across the continuum of care should be able to identify for us the priority focus for each patient. It needs to be a patient-specific focus. We talked about patient-focused care, I think, in 1993, right? And now, and we've been in episode-based care for the last 30 plus years. So we've got to focus on why the patient is here and what do they need. And that to me is the top priority. You know, obviously we talked a little bit about how we can make our healthcare records really support management of information we need for those patients, not managing volumes and volumes of data and inputs that may not be relevant. I think we need to reduce some of the regulatory and burden and reimbursement requirements that actually create the need for more resources that really don't bring value to the patient. I would do a wholesale review of regulatory requirements not only at the federal level, but at the state level as well. With respect to AI, just really focusing on stewardship, guardrails, you know, making sure that the AI is safe and accurate. It's going to be critical. And we have a whole wave of next generation advanced therapeutics that we're working on. We call it our therapeutic innovation stewardship, the multi-million dollar cell and gene therapies. That's another area that would require an entire discussion of itself. But I want to end with transitions of care, because this has been my life's work since my father got sick in 1998. I've written two bills in California, one that went through the legislative process, one that I worked on with the state board. So California is now the only state that requires that for high-risk patients, when they are admitted to the hospitals, the pharmacy is responsible for ensuring the medication list is accurate at admission and discharge. Now, let me take us to where I think the payer-employer relationship partnerships could happen. Payers know who their high-risk patients are, and it's not just about the medications. I happen to focus on that because I'm a pharmacist, but payers know who their high-risk patients are. Employers expend a lot of money on healthcare costs. If we could align to manage those high-risk patients, not just when they show up in our hospitals, we get our cars regularly evaluated, right? We have to fill them with oil, they get tune-ups, whatever. Why don't we do that for patients? Why don't we partner with health plans and employers to identify those high-risk patients? And again, what do they need? So we're being proactive. I came up with a new contraction there. So we could be proactive in identifying what they need. I can tell you, and you're a pharmacist by training too, patients are on probably 30% more drugs than they need to be on, cause adverse events that increase their costs, that increase their employer costs, that we could probably reduce. And there are other things the patient might be, you know, telltale signs of behavioral issues, social issues, and the like.
Okay. Well, that's going to be the final word. And I just want to thank you, Rita. It's been a delight to have you on Conversations with Perry and Friend. You did a fabulous job.
And we're looking at AI and research as well. So, I mean, with the right guardrails and the right stakeholders, AI is extremely powerful. And machine learning is extremely powerful. I think it actually will reduce a lot of work to enable them. Ideally, clinicians to have information to support effective decision making, as opposed to trying to mire through, as I mentioned, you know, a very, very bloated electronic health record. So to bring information to support decision making is really positive. The concern is always, are we going to lose the ability to critically think because we're just going to go with the AI? We're savants, and are people going to actually understand and learn how to treat diseases? I mean, it's kind of like ask someone to do math in their head these days.
Right.
You know, maybe you and I can do it, but I don't bust the ass to the generations after us. I can still add in my head.
I heard that. I heard that. So now let's move into value-based care. We hear that buzzword a lot. What is your organization doing to provide value-based care?
So we will assemble teams around specific diseases and conditions to identify key areas where we believe we can improve the care of the patient and potentially reduce the total cost of care. So I'll give you a pharmacy example. We know that cancer patients, depending on their treatments, are at risk for febrile neutropenia, which means that they could potentially be admitted because their white count plummets after getting certain chemotherapies. So we actually hardwired antimicrobial prescribing into our treatment plan so that a patient who's at risk of an admission because of an infection actually goes home with a prescription for antibiotics. This was done through a multidisciplinary team and also with our IT colleagues. And we actually saw a significant increase in the number of patients going home with antibiotics. Now we're measuring outcomes because we believe, based on what we see in admissions, and this is not just here, this is across the country, patients get admitted when their white count plummets and they get infected. So this is to prevent the infection. So that's like a value-based initiative, if you will. And we have other ones across the organization with different diseases and conditions where we look at how do we reduce the total cost of care and do the right thing for the patient that will actually improve their care once they leave. You know, this notion of patients leaving safely is very, very important.
So is this all germinated inside CDRS, or is a payer working with you or directing you or collaborating with you?
These have been within CDRS. I could get into what I believe would be the ideal state with payers if you want to go there, because I do think there are opportunities to really support not only payers, but employers in reducing overall healthcare costs, because there are a lot of misaligned, models of how payment is rendered in this country.
All right. Well, this is a nice segue to our final question. Okay. Now you get to look at your crystal ball and you say, what do you see as the top five priorities for health systems going forward? What are our top five priorities?
So I would say it's really going to what I'm going to call a hybrid approach to the patient's admission. It's somewhat, I'm repeating somewhat of what I said before. I think the priority is to determine what the patient needs when they go home. So one of the terms I use when I'm teaching is, why is the patient here and what do they need? And the answer isn't just to replace their hip, you know, make sure that they survive their acute myocardial infarction or fill in the blank. We need to look at what are the other factors around the patients. We have the highest percentage of patients over 80 years old at Cedars-Sinai. I don't know if it's in the country, but it's certainly within the state. And those patients and their family members need support. And it may be psychosocial support. It may not even be
medical
support. And so I do think that absolutely has to be a priority. How do we huddle around that patient and in an intelligent way figure out what they need to send them home? And I think that's where AI and technology can help us, because that information that's being fed through the medical record across the continuum of care should be able to identify for us the priority focus for each patient. It needs to be a patient-specific focus. We talked about patient-focused care, I think, in 1993, right? And now, and we've been in episode-based care for the last 30-plus years. So we've got to focus on why the patient is here and what do they need. And that, to me, is the top priority. You know, obviously, we talked a little bit about our how we can make our healthcare records really support management of information we need for those patients, not managing volumes and volumes of data and inputs that may not be relevant. I think we need to reduce some of the regulatory and burden and reimbursement requirements that actually create the need for more resources that really don't bring value to the patient. I would do a wholesale review of regulatory requirements at the not only at the federal level, but at the state level as well. With respect to AI, just really focusing on stewardship, guardrails, you know, making sure that the AI is safe and accurate is going to be critical. And we have a whole wave of next generation advanced therapeutics that we're working on. We call it our therapeutic innovation stewardship, the multi-million dollar cell and gene therapies. That's another area that would require an entire discussion of itself. But I want to end with transitions of care, because this has been my life's work since my father got sick in 1998. I've written two bills in California, one that went through the legislative process, one that I worked on with the state board. So California is now the only state that requires that for high-risk patients, when they are admitted to the hospitals, the pharmacy is responsible for ensuring the medication list is accurate at admission and discharge. Now, let me take us to where I think the payer-employer relationship partnerships could happen. Payers know who their high-risk patients are, and it's not just about the medications. I happen to focus on that because I'm a pharmacist, but payers know who their high-risk patients are. Employers expend a lot of money on healthcare costs. If we could align to manage those high-risk patients, not just when they show up in our hospitals, we get our cars regularly evaluated, right? We have to fill them with oil, they get tune-ups, whatever. Why don't we do that for patients? Why don't we partner with health plans and employers to identify those high-risk patients? And again, what do they need? So we're being proactive. I came up with a new contraction there. So we could be proactive in identifying what they need. I can tell you, and you're a pharmacist by training too, patients are on probably 30% more drugs than they need to be on, cause adverse events that increase their costs, that increase their employer costs, that we could probably reduce. And there are other things the patient might need, you know, telltale signs of behavioral issues, social issues, and the like.
Okay. Well, that's going to be the final word. And I just want to thank you, Rita. It's been a delight to have you on Conversations with Perry and Friend. You did a fabulous job.